You are listening to Money on the Left, a monthly interdisciplinary podcast that reclaims money's public powers for imaginative, intersectional politics, proudly presented in partnership with Monthly Review Online. I'm Billy Soss, Scott Ferguson, and Max Seho. We are very excited this month to share with you a lost episode of Money on the Left titled Resisting Predatory Finance with Raul Carrillo, which was recorded in April 2020, but which is being published now for the first time in our podcast feed. Engaging critically with the rhetorics of taxpayer money and taxpayer identity, which actively circulate today in leftist critiques of U.S. foreign policy, this episode feels as timely and fresh now as it did 3.5 years ago, on the eve of the publication of Raul's essay titled Challenging Monetary Sanctions in the Era of Racial Taxation in the UCLA Criminal Justice Law Review. Raul currently works as an academic fellow and lecturer at Columbia Law School, as well as co-chair of the Columbia Seminar on Full Employment. He researches, writes, and sometimes testifies before Congress about the laws governing financial technology and innovation. A lot has happened with Money on the Left since this episode was shelved in late 2020. One of those things has been an upgraded recording setup and access to software that has allowed us to recover what was, until very recently, a largely unlistenable set of audio recordings. I don't know what happened with that original recording session. I do remember vividly that we were extremely gutted to not be able to publish it at that time, which makes it all the sweeter to be able to share with you now. Thank you to Raul for the conversation and for permission to publish this heavily processed but much improved episode of Money on the Left. Special shout out to Rich Farrell, who produced the transcript, which was for a long time the only way you could access this conversation through Monthly Review Online. Thanks also to Nanin Kula for the theme tune and to Megan Soss for the graphic. Raul Carrillo, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thanks, Billy. Really happy to be here. Longtime hype man, first time participant.
Thank you so much. It's a long time coming, and we're really thrilled to have you here. As we do, we'd like to ask you to start by telling us a little bit about your personal, political, and professional background as they relate to your appearance on the show today.
Sure thing, Billy. So I'm on this podcast in my capacity, as you all know, as the board chair of the Modern Money Network, as the power vacuum behind the throne, so to speak. But I'm happy to sort of walk through my journey and how I got to MMT, which is rich and I think a little bit unique, just like everybody else's. That's sort of how it happens. You don't come to heterodox economics, much less heterodox interdisciplinary studies, without a sort of a wild ride. So I'm happy to take it from the top. I grew up in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands in southern New Mexico, West Texas, where my folks have been for a very long time on both sides. And it is a financial as well as biophysical desert. And I grew up in a lot more relative material comforts compared to my community and my family and my friends. But that allowed me to, I think, start to gain an appreciation of the wide gaps between the level of wealth and income and just, again, resources in our area and for my community versus others. And so I sort of always had this economic justice bent. And given my own family's history, that was always tied in with racial justice. So I grew up on the stories of the Chicano Civil Rights Movement, Cesar's involvement in the Poor People's Campaign and an alliance with Black activists in the South, as well as stories about indigenous rights, etc. And I started to study economic justice in general, or I should say just economics, when I got to college in order to sort of understand the extraction and the massive inequality that I had seen both back home in the United States and in travels in my time in Mexico and other places. And so for me, it's always been really about intertwisted injustices. And when I was studying economics in college, the bottom fell out in 08, right? Like everybody else. And so I was sort of an undergrad learning about why all the things I believed in weren't technically feasible, as we all know. And for me, this was instruction from a lot of the folks who had written the textbooks, a lot of people who had made a career out of sort of capturing political energy, filtering it through neoclassical or orthodox economics and constraining it, right? And that is essentially what happened to me as an undergrad, sort of upwardly mobile dreams of people of color are cast in a certain way. And the economics that attends that is a neoliberal set of economic ideas. And I was pretty indoctrinated. So when everything fell apart in 08, and I couldn't explain to anybody back home why things had happened the way they had happened, despite all my time with these economists, it became increasingly frustrating. And I turned more broadly into the social sciences and into law in particular. And the first MMT thinker I ever read wasn't Dr. Kelvin, wasn't Dr. Chonaba, even though I'm, you know, very close to their work at this point. It was the work of Bill Black, who is a law professor and white-collar criminologist, who wrote a book called The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One After the Crisis. And he also, sort of an interesting life. He was an assassination target of some financiers back during the savings and loans crisis. He has traveled multiple continents, sort of figuring things out. But what he did that was special to me, and he wasn't the only one who did this, but he's the one I was introduced to, was connect some grand theses about austerity and about public finance to predation. And that, I'd say, is the side of my work today. Again, after the crisis, I sort of abandoned economics in general, and then cut to the law. Spent some time working in California on the multi-state mortgage fraud settlement. Then went to law school with a financial reform lens, as well as racial justice lens, et cetera. But didn't really understand money or the deeper roots, I think, of the financial system, although I very much wanted to. And I was lucky enough to meet Rowan in law school. And Rowan Gray was a year ahead of me and had already formed the corpus of the Modern Money Network. And over time, we turned that into what it is today with the help of y'all and many, many other great folks and fellow travelers along the way.
Yeah. So on our reading, it seems that your work insists that we can only fully detect, resist, and overcome racism across the globe in a powerful and systemic way if we adopt the public money lens or the modern monetary theory perspective, which we all variously share here. Perhaps could you say more about how you came to this particular conviction?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Max. So I think that's a fair encapsulation of the aim of my work, both as a scholar and as an organizer and as an activist and as someone who is sort of in the space with y'all. And the way I sort of put it is that for me, certainly my focus has been race. Again, that's the background and the lens through which I came to this, but it's more about predation and oppression in general and the architecture that creates those dynamics, the monetary architecture that lends itself to the exploitation of people of color, as I focus on, but also any sort of folks who are marginalized or oppressed in myriad ways. A lot of people have done similarly great work about austerity, financial regulation, and social reproduction theory. For example, it was Zdravka Todorovka, Donatella Alessandrini. Both have been involved in the MMT community. I came to start focusing on race again because of my background, but also because it struck me that knowledge of the monetary system and knowledge of the financial system has been used as a cudgel against movements for racial justice, movements for social justice, movements for emancipation and the more egalitarian aims. right? Like we all discuss all the time how the how you pay for it question is used as a trump card, but it's really used as a trump card in specific contexts, right? And usually it's to tell people of color or other people demanding rights or that their needs be satisfied. It's telling them to shut up, you know? And that's not the case when we think about, for example, the broader security state, the military, the broader surveillance state, war, incarceration, deportation, etc. The right wingers demand blank checks, right, for the security of the small group of people that they imagine are deserving of care. And I know you all sort of touch on these themes in HD especially, but that is also, I think, a guiding premise of my work. And I really see studying, you know, how Wall Street and Silicon Valley prey on people and then working in the field, how public money financing of whether it be rights or social justice or socialism, or, you know, to paraphrase Dr. King, you can call it whatever you want, but it's a system within which, you know, all of God's creatures are entitled to a certain amount of resources, then you really have to confront the monetary architecture. Right? To stop the predation, you have to have a vision of abundance that cuts at the very roots of why the predation happens in the first place. And for me, MMT makes that sort of crystal in a way that few, if any, other bodies of thoughts across the social sciences do.
You know, without necessarily calling out particular names or anything, do you have a sense of, you know, other kind of schools or fields of thought and practice, like in and around critical race theory, that you feel like are kind of almost there, right? But that this public money lens would kind of advance, you know, what they're doing and enable to kind of realize their own impulses in a way that they're not quite seeing. Like, do you feel frustrated by certain fellow travelers?
So, the way that I frame it is that I think it is extremely difficult to have your eyes on all the balls that are in the air right now. We can't afford to be in silos as far as movements go. You know, we need to be talking about, you know, the Holy Trinity, race, gender, class, but also immigration and nationalism and surveillance and climate change and ecology more broadly all the time. And so the way I try to approach talking to fellow activists, fellow organizers, especially those working towards racial justice, is sort of trying to meet folks where they're at and also come with an open mind as to what I might learn. I think there's a tendency, especially among the white left and the pedigree white left, to zoom in on organizers or just everyday people, you know, trying to make their communities better, and think that they're not demanding a certain thing because they don't get it conceptually. And I think that that has not been the case in my experience. And so I've been a financial regulator right after law school. Then I was a direct services attorney for 3 years. I worked in an organization in New York where we had a financial justice hotline, where folks who were experiencing problems with the debt collectors or landlords or credit bureaus, what have you, problems of financial nature, could pick up the phone and call and ask for help in English, Spanish, sometimes Mandarin, Creole at the time. And what I learned is that people on the ground have an extremely sophisticated view of money. I shouldn't say that I learned that. I should say that I remembered that from my community and my family and from other folks, because that was sort of brainwashed out of me by neoliberal economics. And then, which is sort of forces an MT in a position where it's explaining things that strike people as really jargony and don't necessarily always sound in the register aren't always articulated in an inclusive register. Despite the great work that a lot of us have done here, despite the great work that Stephanie has done, et cetera, right? And so I think that poor folks across the board, they're used to making money through profits, right? They understand where every penny is gone. And in my experience, when you talk to people about the public nature of money, even not necessarily MNT, but whether it be public banking or complementary currency or another kind of economic development initiative, people actually get it. It's no more counterintuitive than the premises of orthodox economics, you know, which are like, assume an apple, you know, and two white guys on an island, and like, they're redistributing the apple back and forth and there's no society, which is not a good model for analysis in the social sciences, right? As we can go on and on about. But so to get back to your question, what I try to do when I engage with folks on the ground, which is maybe a little bit different from when I engage with, you know, critical race theorists who have a known or a different jargon problem, is that I tell folks, you know, I think you know that money is a public thing, that money is a government thing, and look at how the system is jacked in all these different ways. And people, I think, get that. Academics sometimes have a little bit more trouble, partially because, you know, they're locked into the tropes of their interlocutors, for which I don't blame academics of color at all. Nor am I here to say that, like, I have all the answers. But I do think that when you sort of massage or interrogate or just get in conversation with a lot of things that, like, critical race theorists say, for instance, the assumptions are there and they need to be teased out. For instance, there are tons of critical tax scholars who have talked about the ways in which white taxpayers do not necessarily see taxpayers of colors as part of the same social class, right? And yet when it comes to the macroeconomics or the political economy, we still find the tropes of taxpayer money, of the deserving benefit recipient, as Angela Harris at UC Davis says. And that's to credit Professor Harris on actually bringing in NNT and interrogating it in a very constructive way compared to some other theorists. So the long or the short answer is really that I think the seeds of thinking about money more critically are already in a lot of critical race theory. You know, from my understanding of feminist legal theory, they're also there as well. And so what needs to happen is an evolution and a bridging, more so than necessarily a course correction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate that answer. I'll say in my own experience that just talking to folks in my own community, they tend to have an easier time than a lot of academics I know who I talk to about it, right? Because they can begin with like, oh yeah, you know, the money comes from the government.
Yeah, I mean, property comes from the government. Whether a contract is a contract is something that comes from the government. All these like basic things that construct a society that economists want to say are froth from the market or whatever it may be. Like those people, like once they take a minute, like we get it, right? And so why would money be so much different than all these other things that leftists interrogate every day, social movements interrogate every day, right?
Let's stick with taxpayer money for just a little bit. That's an area that you've consistently set your critical sights on, you know, talking about the political and legal construction of the taxpayer as a racialized and racist identity. And recently you published about this in the UCLA Criminal Law Review, and before you published something in Splinter Magazine with Jesse Meyerson called The Dangerous Myth of Taxpayer Money, which, by the way, I found to be a very useful article to use in the classroom. So thank you for that. Could you walk us through your argument here? And while we're sort of also on the subject of perception, maybe reflect a bit about how, you know, say people sort of intuitively understand the publicity of money. Is it the same case with the taxpayer money versus public money argument?
Yeah, excellent question. Excellent bundle of questions there, Billy. I think this is particularly important. I'm happy to talk about this right now, because of the moment that we're experiencing with the uprising and all the very courageous movements and faking that's going on around the country, because this figure the legal and cultural figure of the taxpayer is very central to the creation of mass incarceration, of the policing system, of the general security apparatus that protects private property. And that's obviously not my insight. David Stein, you know, our friend who you had on the very first episode of Money on the Left, will tell you that, as will Virginia Eubanks, a scholar of surveillance, as will, you know, many, many, many other people. It's no secret that in the United States, taxpayer forces have often been reactionary. And I think the best encapsulation of this sort of vision that I've come across this far is absolutely the book Racial Taxation by the legal historian Camille Wolfe at the University of Washington, Bogota. And Dr. Wolfe has done us all a great service by actually going back into court doctrine and digging into archives, and letters between Supreme Court justices, and finding out the extent to which the figure of the taxpayer or taxpayer money or taxpayer rights, or as she terms it, taxpayer citizenship, is central to the story of really the failure of the liberal vision of integration in this country. And so one reason for that is that in order to prevent schools from being segregated, a lot of reactionary forces just reverted to the cultural primacy in the United States of the idea of the taxpayer and of protecting taxpayer funds and having local fiscal control over that which we consider to be critical to society or to social reproduction. And so just to give a little bit of background on Walsh's book, because it's my work wouldn't exist at all without it. We wrote this winter piece, Jesse and I, a couple of years before or a year before Dr. Walsh's book came out, but her book absolutely fundamentally changed the game. So to discuss that book, you know, Dr. Walsh tells the story of racial liberalism of the Warring Court just as much as she tells a story about taxpayer money per se. So for Dr. Wolfe, the attempt by the judiciary, you know, during the 50s and 60s to not integrate analysis of identity with analysis of economics, as y'all discussed frequently, resulted in the sort of material failure to integrate schooling and eventually led to a loss in the journey of actually Chicano civil rights activists and children and families and educators in South Texas to achieve equal funding at schools. Essentially, our team in this lawsuit, which was called San Antonio versus Rodriguez, which happened which was heard in 1976, is that these folks from Mexican American and Chicano schools alleged that their fundamental constitutional right to an education was being violated by the local property financing, property tax financing scheme. And as an MMTer, of course, that makes sort of intuitive sense. Like if something is supposed to be a right or something is supposed to be of critical importance, then why is it not supported by the power of the public purse? Right. And so that's what essentially they were saying, you know, this, we do not have equal schooling because we do not have equal funding, and thus our rights are being violated. And what happened in that case is Dr. Walsh outlines is extremely interesting and important. So Justice Powell, who is, was formerly the superintendent of a local school board back home, turns out is extremely interested in this case and is having back and forth with representatives, taxpayer associations, and then the reactionary folks. And his ruling eventually stands on the idea of taxpayer money, saying it may be true that under some state constitutions, or perhaps even under the federal constitution, there was a right to education, but that doesn't trump taxpayer rights. That's, you know, not exactly the holding, but that's what's important for this conversation. And so it's no lie to say that the federal fundamental right to education died at the feet of the taxpayer money trope. And in our fight for new rights now, that is extremely, extremely important. And I hope we can discuss that in a little bit. But I would like to circle back to this UCLA article in the abolitionist moment. So right now, we are seeing obviously calls to defund the police, which can be an abolitionist demand, is not necessarily, as I understand it, from folks like the organizer Mario Mikowa. But of course, the question is, after you defund police, what do you fund? What do you invest in? And what level, et cetera? And other folks are doing great, great work in this area. My friend and fellow MMT traveler, the sociologist Tamara Knopper, wrote an interesting article in Jacobin a couple weeks ago talking about how the defund demand is an evolution in and of itself that should be lauded. And I absolutely agree. Back after her article talks about how after the Rodney King beatings and what went down in LA afterwards, a lot of folks sort of bought the idea of minority-owned business development and corporate investment, et cetera. And it's taken a long time to get to the defund. And now the question is, what sort of funding for the nurturing world, for the actually safe world, do we want? And I think that fundamentally has to be federal, as the MMT will tell you, for technical reasons. But it also has to be federal for political reasons. And in no small part, it's to avoid this mess of the myth of taxpayer money. And taxpayer money, sorry, y'all, we might have to rearrange this, but I'm just going to keep going here. So the myth of taxpayer money essentially says, whether folks want to admit it or not, the more that you pay in taxes, the more of a damn voice you have in society, right? There's sort of this liberal idea that we are all a monolithic taxpayer class. And because I pay sales taxes on things, I have a lot in common with someone who pays a lot of capital gains taxes, right? And I just fundamentally don't think that's true. Dr. Walsh's work makes it abundantly clear that that's not true. When we think about taxpayers as a social class, to the extent it's a social class at all, it's extremely stratified. It's racialized, it's gendered, it's sliced up, it's diced up, right? And people don't look necessarily horizontally at each other as peers, as peer taxpayers. And in fact, taxpayer money, this again, this idea that you're entitled to more because you are a taxpayer rather than a citizen or a human or, any other kind of subject, is sort of replete within right-wing movements. It's obviously essential to the Tea Party. But it's also essential to, the Charlottesville torchbearers and every other white supremacist force in this country. And it's not just the United States, to be clear. That's where I'm situating this conversation. We're situating this conversation. There's a sociologist, fiscal sociologist, which is a beautiful, beautiful term, a fiscal sociologist at the University of Alberta named Kyle Wilmot, whose work I've just sort of been diving into, who is a scholar of indigenous taxpayer identity, but is also just investigating the global role of taxpayer associations generally. And he finds that taxpayer associations serve a particular role within neoliberalism and within crafting subjectivity in encouraging people to bound their government and see it as a resource extractor than a resource generator, which I think is something that's very familiar to all of us. I should take care to note that, Dr. Wilmot and like Dr. Walsh takes care to note that taxpayer identity doesn't necessarily have to be reactionary. It's, in some ways a mercenary concept, as they say, but it's, it has been wielded, I think, irredeemably by the right in this country, although I know folks have done other work about that. And then, I'm happy to discuss the ways in which perhaps y'all see where it's recoverable. But that's pretty much where I'm at this point. And the UCLA Law Review article, which is really more of a short reflection,
complicates the taxpayer identity within the movement to end monetary sanctions. I'm just going to pause real quick right here, if that's okay. What I'd be welcome and open to doing is sort of having a more integrated or a more detailed conversation about the role of taxpayer identity and whether it's recoverable or not. Max, I know you have like thoughts on that, and I'm sure that y'all have other people with thoughts on that. So I don't want to like push it down so hard if y'all want to have a broader discussion.
So returning to that question of reception, it strikes me that even though it's, I agree with you, probably irredeemable, the taxpayer identity that looms large in all the ways that that you've identified is also like super firmly ingrained and like you sort of acknowledge there, even mobilized by people with good intentions frequently. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know locally, currently, you know, we're talking about cutting university budgets and things like that, and the taxpayer trope is showing up. And I wonder if you might offer some advice for somebody who is concerned about that long insidious history that you've outlined for us and that Dr. Walsh outlined so well in her book, how to, with compassion and respect, offer the alternative. I guess maybe the answer is in the question there, but how do you sort of present this to people humbly?
Sure. Yeah. This is a great set of questions, Billy. I do spend a good deal of time sort of just shouting, stop saying taxpayer money, say public money instead.
Yeah, certainly.
As many of us do. But I think that there's not a monolithic answer. There's not a typecast answer. It is different strokes for different folks. So like the first question you have to ask is, what are folks using the trope to try to achieve, I think? And if it's to give a sort of basic example of one end of the spectrum, if folks are arguing for, racial or gender equity as literally as taxpayers, like as they're filing their tax returns, for instance, today, we're recording on tax day. Oh, we should note that. Anyway. Then that's not necessarily a frame within which to inject like this whole argument, right? It's not going to be as successful, right? But if we're talking, of course, at the federal level, then it's a lot easier. And I think folks are starting to understand that like all the money that the Fed is lending out is not taxpayer money, right? How could it be taxpayer money? Everybody's broke right now. So how does that make sense? I also, and this sort of weaves into the I think pertinent questions regarding the UCLA article and the protest, is what happens when people feel a sense of injustice as taxpayers, especially at the local level. And like lots of folks have argued again against incarceration, against utility gouging, against all sorts of things as taxpayers, and they're not right wingers. And I have some thoughts as to why this is strategically still unhelpful for us, but I want to pause here because I think that you've identified an essential question for this project and for all of us is, you know, given that we pretty strongly think what we think and believe what we believe, you know, so, and the other folks do as well, how do we sort of form a bridge here for people who are very interested in economic justice and social justice?
Like I really like this conversation because it's sort of an open one that still necessarily insists on some sort of hard values from which we're operating and explicitly thinking critically about the historical and contextual framings that are within this concept of the taxpayer identity that you so well draw out and draw together some important scholarship that you've cited in your work. And the thing that in the way I've thought about this in the past that strikes me is what's really interesting about the question of public money versus taxpayer money is that it seems to me to be about framing, ultimately, because if you're thinking with public money, there are, of course, operations of taxation with inside of the public money framework, right? Inside the fiscal tax circuit. And there's many different ways in which we can think about that, right?
100%.
But it seems to me what's crucially important then in sort of maybe synthesizing what has been said already is that framing rhetorically the sort of locus of your claim to being accounted for by governance or in some sort of democratic claim on fiscal authority through taxpayer identity is a problem because it refracts an exclusive vision rather than an inclusive one, which is what the public money vision offers. And so it's not that taxpayers aren't like inside a public money framework. It's precisely that in foregrounding what taxation actually is and what it actually does, the taxpayer becomes resituated within an inclusive structure of claims on democratic governance and accountability. And it seems like that's sort of what's at stake in these questions. And I'd be curious to hear your reflection about that.
Yeah, well, damn, Rumi. So I think that's all, I'd agree with all of that. The problem is that right now, taxpayer money is the encompassing frame. It's the bounding frame, right? And there are claims for equity and justice or revolution that could be made by taxpayers within a public money frame. For me, the more immediate question is, what do we do given how not only exclusive the concept has become in the United States, but how stratified? It's not just that, you know, taxpayers, people who primarily identify as taxpayers, don't see Black and brown taxpayers as taxpayers in the same way that they are. It's also that because of what a progressive taxation structure is, because people pay different amounts of taxes and are in different tax brackets, that also quantifies the concept, right? And I would say it corporatizes the concept as well. Like you become more like a shareholder and less like a rights holder. Does that make sense? Like your claim isn't as a political subject, your claim is as a fiscal contributor. And it's not an economic contributor in general, to go back to your previous point, much less a social contributor or just a general contributor to the public. It's how much dough did you cough up for the tax man when it came around, because that's the only kind of public finance we look at. And it's so twisted in the United States that you know, in fact, we call all sorts of monetary sanctions that aren't taxes, but should be taxes or should be thought of as taxes, as not taxes, right? So fines and fees and court restitution and student loan debt and all these sorts of sanctions that are levied on various people throughout the economy aren't even encompassed within the taxpayer money frame, right? And that becomes especially problematic when we're talking about somewhere like Ferguson, Missouri, which is an open-air debtor's prison, because the Taxpayers Association has destroyed the municipality's ability to raise property taxes. And in fact, now they run on fine and fee money. Like, so the concept, I think, is exclusive, as you were saying, in the American context, in the contemporary American context, at least. But it's also stratified, and it sets people at each other's throats in a way that it doesn't have to. And even if we just want to highlight everyone as a member of the economy as well as a society, there are many other categories that we can use to describe people. And public money is, I think, one of the broader ones.
Just real quickly, there, one of the things that I've thought about, you know, a critical difference between public money and taxpayer money is that the taxpayer identity is something that individuals can latch onto and identify as, and then identify themselves as part of a collective and join a taxpayer association, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas public is a bit more abstract, and like you say, there are a lot of different categories that we can identify on, but there doesn't seem to be something that has such a strong rhetorical cachet as taxpayer that's sort of immediately and readily available. And maybe that's, you know, an important part of that bridge work you were gesturing toward before.
Yeah, I think that's another excellent point, right? And I think perhaps, you know, we still are on a quest for embeddedness, and like we'll find and I invite everyone listening to explore other terms that sort of create an individual connection, as well as making, you know, crystal the points that we make, that MNC makes, that the mountain is public at the end of the day, in terms of its origin, in terms of its generation, in terms of the source of the enforcement, patrolling of its use that occurs throughout, you know, throughout society, the legal system sort of scaffolds. I like public money because for the same reasons, you know, I like public schools still, for instance. But that it does not accomplish yet, or perhaps isn't capable of accomplishing, that sort of connection. And I will, you know, no term is perfect, and I will sort of step to that and admit that. Interested if you have thoughts next, Scott.
Yeah, well, you know, one, I think other great term other than public money is the framing that Delman Coates is running with, which is our money, right? And that makes clear that this is, you know, another way of putting it is this is collective money, right? This already, this relationship already belongs to us, but we need to be turning it in other kinds of directions.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and give that a plus one. Our money establishes a social claim, while avoiding sort of the abstract term public. And like, you know, I said public schools earlier, you know, I like public schools. A lot of people don't like the public schools. A lot of people don't like public assistance. A lot of people don't like, you know, public X, public Y, public Z. So I'm very here for our money. I'm sort of is a board member and frequent collaborator with the Reverend Coates, the Reverend Dr. Coates. I will sort of sorry for not jumping back in you. Thanks for it, Walt Scott.
Thanks. Maybe we can shift gears here. One of the things that you've influenced me a lot on is the kind of important but also kind of tricky question about a politics of rights. And I was wondering if you could kind of lay out for you what, you know, why a politics of rights really matters. What you know, how do you conceive of rights? What's the bad way to conceive of rights? And what's the necessary way to fight for certain rights?
Thank you, Scott. So this is a conversation that's going to make everyone hate me from various different angles. I swear, like my whole vibe is synthesizing, you know, different intellectual traditions and trying to, you know, get them to talk to each other. But this is one area in which I think building a bridge, for instance, between the legal left and left economists kind of requires a lot of folks giving up their premises. And I know that's a bold claim, but I'm here to back that up and have some scholarship going down about this in the fall. So if you were to ask most lefty lawyers right now whether we should be fighting for rights, I think that a great deal of them would say, you know, screw rights. What have rights, you know, ever gotten us? Rights are abstract, indeterminate. They're too slippery, right? They're too slippery. If we fight for that's liberal.
They're superstructure.
Absolutely. They're utterly epiphenomenal. I heard about that on another podcast. Everyone listen to Superstructure with Max and Will Beeman. Anyway, so a lot of the legal left would tell you that, and about 60% of those people live in Brooklyn. I don't mean that in a good way, right? It's not a careful Marxist approach to the law, and it's also one that is predominantly held by white folks. And the sort of back and forth within the left legal academy about rights has often really split along racialized lines, as well as lines of gender. To say nothing of comparative constitutional law debates, etc. And I'm trying not to be too crass about it, but I see this dynamic reproduced amongst lawyers my age, etc., etc. And so, to just give some brief background, in the 80s, Professor Mark Tubbs-Snett, whose work I love, wrote an essay called A Critique of Rights, pretty much outlining what I just said and saying that, rights are too slippery, too shallow, too vague to actually achieve anything, right? And it was pretty compelling, and I have felt persuaded by that argument at times. This argument was replicated in its terms of its ethos with respect to property, contract, tort, and throughout this school of thought known as critical legal aesthetics. So then what happened, some years after Professor Tishnat wrote this essay, which again made some extremely compelling points, and great points to think about political economy in the Soviet world, as well as in the United States and in Western Europe, in places or jurisdictions with similar legal systems. What happened is that a legal scholar and law professor named Patricia Williams wrote a book called The Alchemy of Race and Rights, in which, to paraphrase another critical legal scholar, feminist legal scholar, Robin West, I believe she's characterized it as unwittingly eviscerating Tishnet's essay. And what Professor Williams said is, yes, rights can be all of those things that you just said, but rights are the only thing that has ever achieved the damn thing for marginalized and oppressed people in this country. And that wasn't to say, that there isn't a generative force or power within, for instance, striking, or any other sort of, real political activity, but that the rights were also a necessary component of achieving any modicum of justice, much less equality, for folks, and especially folks of color in this country. And that is the perspective that I have pretty much adopted. And I think that there are, good points made within this debate over the last few decades on all sides that are really worth, really important, and that, I think are outstanding. But one thing that this whole sphere of discourse suffers from is an utter reliance on the premises of orthodox economics, and also, again, the trope of taxpayer money.
Can you talk about some of your work on specific rights, like rights around, our collective work on the job guarantee, a right to a job?
Absolutely. So thanks, Scott. My work on this has been in the form of, presentations and other things this far. But this fall, again, some of the stuff is going to start to see the light of day. And for instance, there's an essay coming out in Tipping Point, the book called Tipping Points in International Law, about the state of international labor law and national labor generally. And what I try to accomplish in this essay, drawing on the work of some of the people we just discussed, as well as various other scholars and economists within the broader MMT world and critical money world, is say that one, job guarantees should be pushed for through international law as sort of messy and difficult and aspirational as that all is right now, but also that international labor law, and specifically human rights law, is totally underpinned by a vision of austerity. And one sort of expects that at this point, now that the Bretton Woods institutions are thoroughly neoliberalized. But a lot of the covenants in international human rights law, for instance, are basically enshrining NIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or even something akin to NARU, the national acceleration wage rate of unemployment, which they use in Europe because they don't like to hide the ball. So there's this sort of problem that NMT comes at about the public nature of money, which you'd think a lot of otherwise extremely incisive legal scholars would sort of be aware of or dig at a little. It plagues the very idea that there is a human right to work, which is something that is promoted by, of course, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also the International Social, also the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, as well as the CEDAW, the Treaty on International Women's Rights, and all these sorts of other, canonical documents of international law. And this myth is, of course, replicated in various national constitutions across the globe, or national labor laws across the globe. But its presence in international law is truly sort of staggering. And of course, there's no global body to coordinate fiscal policy or anything like that. But in placing membership mandates on the members of these covenants, it's utterly, utterly orthodox, and in a way that is damaging to any future for these rights.
So, right, this totally then connects up to, the recent Democratic primary and some of the questions around candidates' different plans for a sort of internationalist vision for not only for climate change mitigation with the Green New Deal, but a sort of a new way to think about how we address things like trade or other sort of interstate questions of political economy, which the vision that you seem to be offering here, right, is one of a vision that takes all of essentially the planet into account and doesn't then seek to fracture, like perhaps some of like Elizabeth Warren's plan for a Green New Deal, an American first based approach to perhaps when one could call them rights, but one could mostly also just call it a sort of more nationalist approach to addressing these international questions. And that's a sort of mosaic, but perhaps you could reflect then upon what your vision of a more internationalist framework for rights in relationship to employment means for the Green New Deal.
I'm not under any illusion that liberal internationalism is going to save us, right? That being said, I do believe that there is a more social democratic form of international human rights that is available. And that's a bit of a contentious thing to say in the legal discourse at this point. But that's because I'm an MMTer. That's because I think that a lot of the reasons that rights are abstract, indeterminate, vague, and slippery are fiscal and administrative, right? And the person who's actually, you know, I owe extreme debt to here is Phil Harvey at the at Rutgers University in Camden. And Phil has been a scholar of, as he says, the law and economics of the right to work. I would say the law and political economy of the right to work for about 30 years. And Phil began his sort of journey by investigating human rights law, but also investigating the transmission of some New Deal insights into international law via the United States, the United Nations formation, and the creation of these various covenants, right? So Phil sort of mapped how FDR's Four Freedoms were eventually transported to Geneva and became the basis of a lot of the second generation of rights that actually is enshrined in international law, but we do not have in a real way in the United States. And Phil pointed out that amongst other problems, the issue here is that the bills, the actual legislation for direct job creation caps things at inappropriate levels. It creates a sort of clear maps for courts to follow when they're trying to determine if the government should shell out to redress a violation of a right to work, and all these sorts of other operational or administrative problems. And now Phil's not an MMT, and in fact, Professor Harvey and I disagree on how the job guarantee should ultimately be financed, for instance. But he did make this point that this connection between public finance and rights has to be totally revisited. And my contention is that if they're fundamental rights, then they demand blank checks in the same sort of way that the Pentagon does, that these sort of other, you know, atrocious, voracious maws demand without anybody batting an eye. I mean, like, you know, we bat an eye over here on the left, and the liberals bat an eye too, but, you know, it never really changes. And speaking of Pelosi, Shepherds and Trump's military bills, you know? And the reason for this is not just that I'm an MMTer and I think it's technically possible, is that the resiliency and the stability of rights enforcement depends upon full funding. And so, as Dr. Harvey said, a big reason, the distinction between job guarantee and a, you know, direct job creation is that enforceability is the individual right. And there's an allergy to judicial enforceability of rights on the left because we don't trust the courts. And that's understandable. But Dr. Harvey sort of empirically showed that if you have clear tests for what's supposed to happen, for instance, when someone can't, you know, can no longer work at a particular job, or there's just an ecological problem with them at that job site, they don't get along with people, et cetera, what's supposed to happen in terms of redress, then the courts are more willing to follow these sort of rubrics. And I think the missing piece is, again, the funding. The funding has to be open-ended if it's to be a fundamental right. And that doesn't mean that everyone's going to flood the job guarantee all of a sudden, because, you know, you still have to want to do that sort of work at that sort of wage level with that set of benefits, et cetera, et cetera. But if people can't gain redress, if they're kicked out of the job guarantee program, or if they're not allowed in because of their race, their gender, their sexual orientation, whatever it may be, then the rights aren't real. So you need something like an MMT vision to ballast anything like a social democratic or socialist vision of rights, anything like even the New Deal vision of rights. If you cap them with a trust, if you bound them with the pot of money with a trust fund, or tether it to a tax, God forbid, on your attacks on your enemies, then you're going to run out of money. And you know, not in the grand sense, but you're going to run out of money in the administrative sense, and the program is going to fail. People are going to hate it, And if it doesn't, if a job guarantee can't, you know, consistently hire people to produce things in the public eye that, you know, so that people are perceived as successful, as you all said, then it's not going to take off as a political enterprise. And the Green New Deal doesn't just include the job guarantee. It also includes a housing guarantee, an education guarantee, and a healthcare guarantee, right? So we've got four rights we need to fund. And I think we need to be just as voracious and, you know, as fucking loud as the right wingers when it comes to providing the resources and the structure that we need to create and reproduce anything like a just society.
Yeah, beautifully put. And this actually recalls a kind of slogan that I came up with last year that I actually haven't thought about in a while, which inalienable rights require inalienable money.
Exactly, Scott. And
that's beautiful.
I'm sorry, I didn't think of that off the top of my head. I think yours is better, once again.
I wanted to wind us down by letting you talk a little bit about the advocacy that you've been up to recently on the Hill, you know, to include things like your critique and commentary on the Libra Facebook currency, and anything else you might like to talk about.
Sure thing. Thanks, Billy. So yeah, for about 10 months now, I have been working with a consortium of labor groups, consumer advocates, financial reform advocates, anti-surveillance advocates, digital rights advocates, antitrust advocates, and various other folks on a progressive left response to what's going on in the financial technology sector. I know y'all have had Rowan and various other techie people on here before. My role is not really as an engineer or as an architect. I get to break shit, right? I get to say when things shouldn't be allowed to exist as they're proposed, based on, you know, various bodies of financial regulation law and privacy, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what I've been up to for, roughly the last year, and will be, continuing to do for this foreseeable future. And to connect it to, you know, our discussion, I'll tell you that, in my work around the Hill and, again, with all these advocates, the MMT perspective has actually been essential, because what's happening right now in the financial technology or hashtag fintech sector is what we can loosely call the automation of finance, right? To quote Brett Squat, what we can loosely call the automation of finance, to quote Brett Scott in the UK. But it's also much bigger than that, right? What we're seeing is Silicon Valley starting to exercise monetary power and vie for monetary agency in a way that mostly banks previously, right? And because they're not banks legally, they get to get away with a lot of shit, right? And this is predation in the same way, as Wall Street's targeting certain people to bring into a shadow financial system is. But it's, I'd argue, orders of magnitude more scary because of surveillance, right? Because the way that the internet works, heads up, is that it takes our data, right? Or in some terms, it creates data about us in ways that is punitive. And so all these big tech companies are starting to move into the financial services space, and particularly into the payment space. And the reason for that is that it's the next data frontier. So right now, Facebook knows that it knows what you like, essentially. and it has the content of your communications with, you know, people who are near and dear to you in your life. It doesn't necessarily know what you want or what you would spend money on beyond what you like and beyond the ads you click on, etc. With payments data, despite the existence of various thin legal firewalls and a few technological firewalls, is that they want the payments data and your social media data and also the know more value so they can sell you another goddamn ad, but also so that they can increase their general economic and political power over the globe. And the worst example of this is something called the Facebook Libra Project, which is, as I argue in something called the Libra Black Paper, that was created with the Americans for Financial Reform Education Fund, the Demand Progress Education Fund, is that they're creating a combination shadow banking system and global financial surveillance dragnet. And they're not even hiding it. So the money is going to serve as the basis for broader financial infrastructure, as every MMTer knows. And, you know, that's the goal if you want to create power, right? And mimic the ways of the sovereign in some fashions. But also the goal is to watch how you move the money. Now, banks already do this to a far greater extent than most people are aware of, but their business model is not selling that data or sharing it, as Facebook would call it. And so what we're seeing is a giant collision between Silicon Valley and Wall Street. It includes all these ticky-tacky startups, which can be predatory and dangerous and exploitative in their own way. But we're seeing Amazon and Facebook and Google and Apple, not to mention the much larger companies in China, sort of enter the monetary realm. And in the United States, it's particularly troubling because we don't have any fucking privacy law. We literally don't. This is another instance in which the folks think they have rights, but they're like consenting in a boilerplate contract to, you know, having your face analyzed, you know, and otherwise you don't get to use the service. And sometimes it's opt out, you know, no one gets punished to the extent that they should. That might be exaggerating a little bit, but not too much. So we're seeing an utterly unregulated Silicon Valley, fingers crossed that changes soon, but as of now, a wild west, a necessarily imperialist Silicon Valley start to do some of the things Wall Street did with the added layer of surveillance, which also connects to, state surveillance because the NSA and other organizations, as Edward Snowden showed us, have a backdoor into Facebook's facial recognition database of protesters, for instance, or people who aren't following the rules about pandemic guidelines. So, sorry to ruin your day, but that's what I'm working on, with the politicos. Basically, the Facebook Libra Project, again, is a combo. It's the 1-2. It's financial extraction and it's data extraction, right? But it's hard to really overstate the ambition here. When this project started, it was sort of just a middle finger to regulators and to, you know, policymakers generally. And my sort of personal thesis is that Facebook knew it was doing this. That's sort of just how it rolls. The old slogan is, move fast, break things, you know, regardless of whether they're laws, apparently. And not that I'm here to promote law enforcement, but in this context, like, where are the cops at, you know? And I mean that in a decarceral way. I mean financially. yeah, it's just, you know. And so But the idea is to create these coins, which are called stable coins, as opposed to unstable coins, like Bitcoin. They're supposed to maintain value as a medium of payment across various jurisdictions and economies across the globe. And for now, it's just these coins, right? And then Facebook gets to create a digital wallet that people use for transactions, which collects its own data, et cetera, et cetera. The whole thing is actually not technically a Facebook enterprise because they've taken great pains to shield themselves from liability by creating an association in Geneva, Switzerland, which is, of course, famous for its very strong banking laws. And it sort of has this nonprofit techie altruistic clause, right? Which is fundamentally more liberal. It's, we're going to create a payment method and eventually a whole financial infrastructure, including lending and presumably credit scoring and all types of things, that is going to bank the unbanked, not just in the United States, but, or not just in Europe, but across the world and perhaps especially in the global south. That was the message that came out. And in fact, in September of 2019, the CEO of Facebook's arm of the enterprise, a guy named David Marcus, boasted that Libra is going to allow the free world of the Western nations to preserve the influence that, in my opinion, is necessary to maintain a good balance in the world. So it's a little difficult to not just call this an imperial grab, right? And the way they're going about this is equivalent to monetary primitive accumulation, as Matt Forstatter in the MMT world describes it, right? They are, defining what the method of payment is. The idea is that maybe it's not necessary for taxes, or it's not accepted as taxes right away, but it's needed for various other services if you're interested in quick payments or if you're interested in digital payments at all. And there's a sort of social or socio-legal necessity that's there, given the weak infrastructure in the financial sectors of some economies around the world, right? And so really the data grab doesn't work unless you get the currency grab, right? So then it's currency substitution. So then the idea is, instead of dollarizing some of these economies, you liberalize them, right? And then you can hoover up data as well. And, maybe folks don't have IDs in a certain country. So in that case, what they'll do is allow them to use their Facebook profile and a facial scan, a retinal scan and a fingerprint scan and all kinds of other things to get into the banking system. And they have all these sort of nasty techtopian plans, right? And of course, they cast them as altruistic because, if you've ever had the unfortunate, you've ever been in the unfortunate spot of like being next to like a finance bro at a bar, you know that they know they're jerks, right? But Silicon Valley like sort of thinks they're good still. And they see this really as a sort of civilizing force throughout the world. And so it's fundamentally an imperialist enterprise in many ways. And like, why in the world would anyone who cares about any sort of justice at all allow this to happen? No one asked Facebook to do this. Like, what is it going to mean if folks like Dr. Silla were fighting against CFA Franc in Senegal, have to contend with the internet trying to beam in and assume and take away its monetary sovereignty, even if they're successful against Macron? How is that supposed to, in any way be good for anybody or for any of the things that we believe in, obviously? But Izzy Kaminska at the Financial Times has called this imperialism by stealth. It's just as naked when you look at the facts, but it's coded in this California ideology gloss.
Yeah, it also reminds me to kind of bring this back to the States and to the Fed, right, that recently Jerome Powell is on record, you know, weighing the idea of, you know, public Fed banking, right, giving everybody, banking all the unbanked, you know, what this California ideology in Silicon Valley is purportedly wanting to do, and, you know, what is his answer? Like, oh, no, 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 that's a terrible idea. The banks will hate it. The private sector will hate it. Like, yeah.
Right. It's like, go on. So that's hilarious. But I'm glad you brought this up, because there is a... the war on cash isn't just a war on cash anymore, or the gentrification of payments, as Red Scott calls it. It is now, you know, as our colleague Rowan Gray says, it's a fight for the soul of the future of digital money. It's becoming pretty clear that in many ways the monetary system is going to become increasingly digitized. You know, obviously most money is digitized. All the MNT metaphors, or the, at least the Moslarian metaphors, sort of, get at that, you know, keyboard strokes, you know, electrons, et cetera, et cetera. But, really what we mean by this is the decreasing presence of cash as a form of money, and, therefore of privacy in many ways, right? And the innovative work that's being done around money as private, as paper cash in the digital world, is mostly being done by, you know, people I have a lot of respect for, but are not interested in a public money framework, right? Like the folks who create Monero or Zcash, to my understanding, are interested in private money. They're not interested in private public money, to use an unhelpful distinction. But that really is what's going on here. And there's this conversation about creating a central, you know, digital bank currency system, some call it the digital dollar, et cetera, that really sort of involves the core of this debate. And I just want to make clear that I support absolutely bank accounts for all, basic financial services for all. And I don't think that that's a neoliberal idea. I think that's necessary in a variety of both of traditions or of visions or meanness. But the issue, of course, is then when credit or private credit or lending becomes the purported vehicle for curing poverty, right? And that gets predatory real, real quick. And it gets extra predatory with fintech, because again, we're not just talking about potentially outrageous, you know, interest rates. We're talking about the data. And we're talking about increasingly building a scored society, as Dr. Knopper and also Law Professor Frank Pasquale have both written about. These apps, as Dr. Knopper says, they analyze one's digital character, right? They create an image of you, which is then shared, probably not just within, you know, the financial world, but within a whole sphere of industries that now rely on data collection. And finance becomes another gateway by which people just, by which, you know, corporate tycoons gain more and more information about people. But it is not just that. Like, it's not just the ads, and it's not just, you know, the antitrust violations either. It's that it's the insane surveillance that crosses over to state surveillance, because again, you know, surveillance, the government is usually one subpoena away from getting most information. It requires these big tech companies through something called the Upstream Program with the NSA to you know, release certain kinds of data that includes the contents of communications, for instance, in clear text, you know, they can see everything. And this becomes especially dangerous when you consider the color of surveillance. So a lot of these fintech products are
marketed specifically at communities of color and other marginalized folks, because they are folks who are more likely to not have a traditional form of banking account or be excluded from the quote unquote mainstream system. And I would argue that this is predatory. And it's not just predatory because of the financial extraction, which is bad enough, but it's predatory because you are jeopardizing the health and safety of people of color in a white supremacist state that is going absolutely completely bonkers right now. And we know that these companies have to fork over data to federal law enforcement. And some of them willingly fork over data to local law enforcement. That's what Amazon Ring is. In order to protect the white suburbs and protect their property and their goddamn taxpayer money from, super predators, et cetera, and the embryonic criminal class, as Jared Bridges would say, like, you have to create more surveillance. Workers must be watched. Delivery folks must be watched. People who borrow money must be watched. This is a whole ethos. And Amazon, like, has this camera that says, what's up, to anybody who comes up. And then that tag goes to the cops. And so what happens if a delivery worker is also a protester right now? What happens then? And even outside of the protest context, surveillance is the norm for Black folks in the context of public assistance and predatory debt. And it's the case for many, many other people, including Muslims, for instance, right now, and anyone who's considered to be, a threat to the Trump administration. Let's be real. So this whole fintech enterprise, I think, needs to be chilled extremely. Like, everybody needs to cool it. And I understand that lots of folks are into financial innovation, and I would welcome their skills at blockchain or whatever it may be within the public sector. Because if the goal really is to include people, then NFTers know what the right organ is for that, right? And I think in order to push back against predation, we have to empower public money for public power in myriad ways, and not just as it is a monetary enterprise narrowly, but as a social.
I think with that, I just wanted to say what a pleasure it's been, Raul, to have you on Money on the Left. Finally, after all of these episodes, I think this is episode 28 now.
Wow. I'm 28th. I yell, this 28th? Thanks, Max. It was a real pleasure to finally jump on here. Hope to return fairly soon, and I will be listening to every episode and getting it out there. Y'all keep on trucking.